Welcome to the Personal Brain Trainer Podcast. I'm Dr. Erica Warren.
And I'm Darius Nomdaron, and we're your hosts. Join us on an adventure to translate the scientific jargon and brain research into simple metaphors and stories for everyday life. We explore executive function and learning strategies that help turbocharge the mind.
Come learn how to steer around the invisible barriers so that you can achieve your goals. And this podcast is ideal for parents, educators, and learners of all ages.
This podcast is brought to you by Bullet Map Academy, and we have a free dyslexia screener app called Dyslexia Quiz. It's fun, engaging, and interactive app. Try it now. Just search for Dyslexia Quiz on the App Store and see how your scores differ from your friends and family.
This podcast is brought to you by GoodSensoryLearning.com, where you can find educational and occupational therapy lessons and remedial materials that bring delight to learning. Finally, you can find Dr. Warren's many courses at LearningSpecialistCourses.com. Come check out our newest course on developing executive functions and study strategies.
So, what's the topic for this week, Erica?
I think we're going to talk about how we are executive functioning coaches and how we do this with the students in our own practice.
We're going to do it slightly differently in that this isn't going to be like some pitch. What we often do, Erica and I, is just sit down and talk about how we're doing executive function in our own realms. And the interesting thing is we're like two Venn diagrams, Erica, aren't we? We're very close overlap, but we're not completely covering one another. So there's just so much to learn from one another. And that's one of the reasons why I want to do these podcasts, because I learn so much just from learning and sharing with you. And today, just hearing what you were talking about, you've got this big project in the back burner right now. You're putting all of this into a course, developing it for kids. Tell me more about how you're going about that.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because executive functioning coaching seems to be so big right now. And particularly after COVID, I've just never had so many people bombard me with, oh my gosh, my kids are really struggling and they don't know how to plan. They don't know how to organize. They're really struggling with self-initiation. They get the homework done, but they don't turn it in. All of these issues, or they just don't know how to manage the system because everything has gone online. And with everything online, there's a whole new way of organizing. And some teachers put the assignments in maybe Google, and others use other platforms. And even within the platforms, there are different places that you can put assignments. So kids miss assignments, or they forget that they did it, or they did it and just didn't hit that little red button. But it's really interesting to see, or even the parents calling and saying, you know, my child's about to take off for college and I don't feel like they have any study skills. And study skills really has a lot to do with executive functioning. So I thought, wow, maybe I need to make a course because there are just not enough true executive functioning coaches around. I think there are a lot of people that are like, ooh, look, there's a need. I can be an executive functioning coach. But as easy as it seems, it's actually quite complex.
That's quite an interesting point about, ooh, I can be an executive functioning coach. Because do you find that somebody might say, well, I'm very well organized. I'm good at organizing stuff. So I can coach you how to organize. But it's kind of like, just because you're an expert in something doesn't mean you're a good teacher in it.
Yes, I'm so glad you said that. And it takes me back to graduate school where we talked about the master morality versus the coping morality. So people that are masters at something where it comes really easily don't make good teachers because they get frustrated with people that can't do it. And they're like, why can't you do it? It's so easy.
Oh, wow.
And I hear that all the time, all the time from parents. And the parents are like, I don't know what's wrong with them. It's so easy. Why can't they just hit the red button? Or why can't they just give themselves a reminder? It's so easy. And I think teachers really struggle with teaching executive functioning because it's so easy. For them, it's a no-brainer. But for these kids, it's really complex. They get lost in all of these details.
In a way, becoming a teacher is self-selecting, because you have to be so organized as a teacher. So often teachers that don't make it are the ones who don't have the executive functioning skills. And it's a rare teacher that gets through without some decent executive functioning skills.
I think you're right. So there we go. So there's the master morality. So people where it's a no-brainer, it's really easy, aren't very good at teaching that stuff. Now, people that have more of a coping mentality, whereas executive functioning was a little bit more difficult, a little bit more tricky, then they tend, and now if they learn to master it and then they teach it, they're really good at it, because they know how to break things down to the individual pieces, the components. They have compassion. They know what to do to reach those kids that are struggling. And they tend to be really patient and understand that complexity, which doesn't feel like a complexity to those that know it.
That is so fascinating. I love that. And do you know what? That really helps me, because I often feel really guilty when I teach people how to stay organized. And that's what I do at Bullet Map Academy with the students, how to organize their ideas visually and write well-structured essays in exam conditions on time. And there's a huge process that goes into each one of those stages, you know, how to take notes to organize your ideas, how to structure an answer, how to structure the essay, how to then do it in school, which you don't necessarily have someone helping you or guiding you, how to then do it in an exam condition, and then how to do it on time, because there are often an exam is not an English test, it's an organization test. Can you actually organize your time to get the essay done? Can you actually organize the thoughts into a structured essay that answers the question? There's so much organization in all of this. And yet, I'm terrible at organization, naturally terrible at it. I have to be so intentional about it. So that helps me a lot, because I've had to be so intentional. I've developed a system that I can then say, look, here's a system. If you don't find it natural, you can go through this manual system and become automatic at organizing yourself, but you have to manually go through a process first.
That's right. So you're hitting it from the coping mentality. And so you know how to truly teach executive functioning. It's interesting, because I think that I developed some strategies as a young kid and became really good at executive functioning. Oh, I really became a first minute person. So I got things done immediately. And then I learned from other people around me, like my advisor in my doctoral program. This woman was a powerhouse. She could get so much done. She could write so many books and articles. And I went over to her house one day, and her house was impeccably clean and organized. And it just blew me away. Her desk was empty. And I just looked at her and I said, how do you do it? She said, there's a secret to this. I was like, tell me, what is it? She said, you do things once and only once. If you get your mail, you don't open it until you can get through it. So you only do things once. And whenever I apply that to my life, it's amazing what gets done. I tend to be juggling so many balls that I do have to create a list, and I have a little list here, but my list never lasts more than a day or two. So many people are like a week or 2 weeks behind, and that's not the case for me. I work in the moment. The longest anybody is going to wait for anything is a few hours typically for me. So, but yeah, it's funny. I'll hear from people and they're like, oh yeah, well, I won't be able to get to that for 2 weeks. And I think, oh my gosh, if I did that, you know, my whole world would fall apart, because that Jenga, it would feel like a Jenga tower that was just way too tall and too toppling. It would just surely crash down. That I like to keep my little Jenga small and sturdy and deal with them quickly before it builds into some kind of tower that feels overwhelming.
That sounds Very, very attractive, Erica. How do you make sure then that you don't get pulled to the side by the tyranny of the urgent? So something comes up and you go, oh, right, well, I'll respond to that. So the person or the thing that shouts the loudest gets your attention, and that the quiet thing that doesn't shout so much doesn't get your attention.
That's a really good point. You know, I do tend to work pretty long hours. And there are those days where I can think of situations where my computer crashes, for example, and all of a sudden I have to go into fixing this problem for a day and a half, you know, or you have a tax issue or something that just pushes your whole Jenga pile to the side, and you just have to go into triage and figure this out and then pull it back in front of you. I guess that's another reason, in from my perspective, of why I never have a list that's too long, because
okay,
there has to be room and space for a day and a half time sucking emergency that where you have to kind of drop everything. And it's interesting because, you know, people say, oh, I don't have time for this, I don't have time for that. But we do. We always make time for those kinds of emergencies in our lives. So to me, that's why it's important to keep the list tight and small.
Okay. Tell me about what you're doing with this program then. So tell me more about this executive functioning program. What's going on behind it? From what we've learned in our discussions so far in the podcast, is there anything that you've kind of learned and or shared in that? And how is it expressing itself when it comes to doing it with children?
Well, you know, this course is really interesting because, you know, I want to make it available to kind of all ages. So I like to bring in some animation that I create, kind of animated videos. And then I also like to have some other ones that are not so animated. And it's always a trick because if I make it too elementary, then the high school students are going to be like, oh, this is stupid, I don't want to do this. But if I make it too complex, the little kids are going to be like, I'm lost, this is not engaging.
What I was actually asking was that what kind of techniques are you actually teaching?
So you know, it's funny. I have to wrap all of these techniques in something engaging, whether it's a cute little video or an assessment that gets them to start to think about themselves and discover where they are right now, to like little handouts that they can move through to see how they can apply this new idea to their life. It's a really complex process. And even going back to what we were discussing before is like, how do I fit this into my life? This is something that I haven't purposely scheduled into my life. I work on it whenever I have a moment where I don't have anything urgent to do. So I've kind of been weaving it in, I guess, for the past 6 months. And then now in December, I'm kind of pushing things to the side and focusing on this so that I can get it done, hoping, you know, by January 2021.
This is kind of instead of the book deal that you were thinking of doing about executive function 6 months back, and you kind of, instead of writing the book, you're kind of now writing the course instead. Is that the idea?
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, because I was approached by a publisher to write a book. And when I started looking into it, I saw that there were a lot of people that had already written books. And I thought, you know, and there's a lot of decent content out there, but I don't see anybody offering a specific course, because again, you know, we have a lot of these people that says, oh, I'm really good at organization, I can do this, I'm good at time management, I can teach this, but they don't necessarily know how to break it down into these coping pieces, these minuscule pieces to reach these kids that are really struggling with this process. And so this course is actually for someone that technically wants to be an executive functioning coach. They could go through it and then they can actually use it with the students. It could be a parent that wants to use it with their kids, because we all know that it's really hard for a parent to teach a child, but they probably could if they used something like this, because this is an external resource. And, you know, when adolescents never want to listen to their parents. However, if you That's were to right. do this, But, you know, the idea is just to break it into just manageable chunks, manageable modules, and making it engaging and fun and ways for them to, for example, one of the little videos that I did is a cute little animation about, you know, a disorganizer, and there are these different little characters that I represent as little balls, in fact, or spheres, I guess. And there's a disorganizer, there's a multitasker, there are four different characters. And the kids get to take an assessment to see which one they're most like. And then they learn, okay, well, you really want to be more of a unitasker. So the systematic unitasker is the one that you want to be most like, because that's the one that gets through their homework the fastest and does the best. And they can learn what they can do. Then they have to think about what they have to do themselves to become more like the systematic unitasker.
Help me understand a little bit. I found it fascinating speaking to you about dyslexia and executive function.
Yeah.
And executive function and ADHD. And, you know, there's lots of these processing difficulties, phonological stuff, dyslexia, difficulty processing movement, which is dyspraxia. Then there's dysgraphia, difficulty processing the writing movement, dyscalculia, and ADHD in there as well. And there's like these circles that overlap each other, and many of them co-occur with one another. But am I right in thinking that they all tend to overlap one another, and that joining of them is often in that area of executive function?
I think you're right. It's often, I don't think it always is, but it often is. I mean, every now and then I'll meet a kid with learning challenges, and actually their gift is executive functioning. They're really, really good at that. And that's what helps them pull through. And I think in some ways I might've fit kind of in that realm. Although there were pieces of executive functioning that I had to really develop. And it's funny, I put, for example, memory strategies under executive functioning, because I think of memory strategies as a tool to improve encoding or improve processing, to be more intentional, to be able to truly drop in the moment and digest material and then just get it lodged in long-term memory. And memory strategies was something that I really had to develop over time, and make a conscious choice to really learn all of those tricks and tools, and found it really fun and engaging. And memory strategies are really fun to learn, and they're even more fun to apply. And when I work with kids and they come in and they're like, oh, I've got a test tomorrow, I'm like, yes. And they're like, why? I'm like, we get to do memory strategies. They're so much fun. And we just bring a lot of play into it, which is great, because then it also addresses the anxiety piece that most kids have when it comes to taking a test. And if you can get them to come up with these ridiculous, silly little memory strategies, it gives them confidence, but it also kind of triggers a little bit of a giggle. And once they trigger that little giggle, it gives them that little dopamine burst, and it really kind of calms down the amygdala, and they're able to move through the memorization and the access of the information. Because how many times have you been in a test and you can't access the information? You're like, oh, what is it? What is it? What is it? And you get out of the test because you're not anxious anymore, and it comes back to you. Oh, it's awful. So really addressing that anxiety piece is really important.
So we had the three elements of executive function. One of them was working memory,
inhibitory control, and cognitive flexibility.
So could it be that you were strong on inhibitory control and cognitive flexibility, but maybe your working memory needed to be cleared faster with memory techniques to maximize your working memory? Would that be an accurate characterization of your executive function process there?
I would say, yeah, probably. You know, I think initially my inhibitory control was a little off. I had a lot of attentional issues when I was little, and actually discovered that I was allergic to preservatives. And as soon as I got off of preservatives, then I didn't have as much trouble with attention. But yeah, I can remember how frustrated my mother would get trying to work with me to learn things. And I'd just be falling off the chair and rolling on the ground. And I just couldn't focus. And I was just so spent. Once I got off of preservatives, it made a profound difference. And I have to say, later on in my life, in my 30s, when I gave up starch, sugar, and all processed foods, and anything that's chemical-based and went completely organic, oh my gosh, my cognition improved tenfold, you know? And it's interesting, they're little, and we'll talk about this in another episode. There are other supplements that I take that also help to improve my cognition dramatically, where I feel so much crisper and clearer.
I think it's really helpful to keep having those three elements clear in our minds, you know, that working memory, inhibitory control, and cognitive flexibility. And if we take those three things, elements, and look at the landscape of dyslexia, ADHD, additional support needs, etc., how do you see that landscape and executive functioning fitting within them all at the moment in school and in the world? Because you talked a little bit about how all these parents are getting in touch. How do you see that happening? You've got a bit of an insight into that, maybe not as a teacher, but as a outside of the system, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely see that the schools need to teach executive functioning skills. And you know, with all the research that I've done at late, it's really interesting to see that executive functioning or your capacity to learn it starts almost the day you're born, where yeah. it's developed. And the interesting thing is it's not fully developed until you're in your early 20s, sometimes mid-20s. So it's a really extensive process. But the big open window for developing executive functioning is with the little kids, elementary school. That's where they have the greatest capacity to learn executive functioning skills. And, you know, we do so much of it through games, like little hand clapping games or songs that we do and little dances we do with the songs and thinking out loud. And little kids, what do they ask you all the time? Why? 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 And if you're able to answer that and then think about your own thinking out loud, all of these things are developing executive functioning skills. Play develops executive functioning skills, you know, because if the, say the little girl is having a tea party, ooh, well, they have to plan out their tea party. Well, wow, that definitely works on a lot of those things. And what are you going to bring to your tea party? Planning out, oh, and my goodness, visualization, right? When you're having a little imaginary party, it's all about visualization, which is, to me, the cornerstone of working memory.
Well, I remember when we met, I think it's probably a year or so ago now, you woke me up to executive function in a much more intentional and aware way. Whereas before then, I was looking at the difficulties of dyslexia with students and using mind mapping. And I ended up creating this combination of Cornell notes, mind mapping, and 7 dyslexia and executive functioning techniques all into this one single page process. And it was then you said, Darius, that's for dyslexia, but you're doing executive functioning skills there. And I realized that basically, you can be dealing with the phonological processing, which is the first area that this processing differences emerge. But then all the other areas of processing, slow processing, and we talked about slow processing before, is manual processing, as opposed to just being slow. You still have capacity, but it's much more manual than the automatic. And I realized, I think nearly every week, I just go from one week to another with student after student after student and realize how much everything comes down, so much comes down to executive function.
You know, and another piece that I want to throw in there just popped into my mind, which is so common for kids with dyslexia, is rapid automatic naming, which you could say is under processing speed, which is your ability, they call it RAN, which is just the acronym for it. But it's your ability to process information quickly or to name things. So if I throw up a picture of broccoli, can you come up with a name for broccoli? You know, can you come up with a name for, you know it, but can you access it quickly? And so many kids struggle with that. But I really do feel like that is a piece of executive functioning because you have it in your memory banks, but are you able to access it? So is that a piece of working memory? Perhaps. You know, what I often think about with RAN is that it's there, that I think of my brain sometimes as like a disorganized room. So if I don't organize the information before I encode it, and I just throw it into my memory banks, I may be able to access it. I may not be able to access it, but the way to organize it in a way that you can access the information takes me back personally, and something that I do with a lot of my students are those memory strategies. Things like hooking. Yes. What is hooking? Hooking is finding the answer in the question. So if you want to know how, you know, what the word benevolent means, I always say to my students, well, what do you see in the word benevolent? Does it sound like something? Do you see any other words in it? Let me give you that example and you can try it. So write down the word benevolent.
All right, I'll write it down. Okay.
Write down the word benevolent.
I'm going to write it down. Here we go.
When you write down benevolent, I want you to think about, and people at home can do this too, you know, write down the word benevolent, B-E-N-E-V-O-L-E-N-T.
Okay, I've got it down.
Do you see any words? What's the first thing that you do? Do you, maybe it sounds like something, maybe.
It sounds like ben or benefit.
Oh, nice, 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 nice. Okay, so you've got ben. So benevolent means kind-hearted. So for you, I would say, could you imagine that, right? You said ben, like benefit. You said beneficial? What did you say?
Like benefit. You
like benefit.
Maybe benefit someone.
Benevolent. That's right.
Benefit, you know.
And maybe even have a friend named Ben and he's kind-hearted. Or maybe even Ben has a benefit, which is a kind-hearted thing to do. Well, people see different things in the word. If you look at the word, you may also see the word lent. If you lent somebody something, that's a kind thing to do, right? Well, I've used this strategy for many years, so I've heard many strategies from many different people. Some people see bene, which is the prefix, which means good.
Yes.
I personally saw something, or I heard something, benevolent sounded like be not violent.
Okay.
You know, but my favorite one of all time was, and this was after like 2 years of doing it. I had a mother say, oh, love. I was like, what do you mean love? Where? She said, it's right
it's
in the middle.
Backwards.
It's right in the middle of the word backwards. The fact that that's the first thing she saw blew my mind. But this is
dyslexic.
When we do memory strategies, it's so important that we don't give the memory strategies to the kids, but we let them find it themselves. So this is an example of one of the various memory strategies that I teach in the course, but also teach my students. And letting them find whatever it is that they find in that word so that you can create a story that hooks the information together so that when they have that kind of rapid automatic naming or they're in a test and they can't access the information, the question is attached to the answer so that you're organizing it in the memory banks in an efficient way.
So it's when you say rapid automatic memory, okay.
Naming.
In many ways, it's rapid manual memory. So sometimes, and I know I'm fixated on this manual versus automatic, so please forgive me for pushing it to its
limits. And go back and explain that to people that haven't heard that podcast.
So if you haven't heard it, I have slow processing. My daughter has slow processing. Lots of my students have slow processing. And how do you explain slow processing when you have a high IQ? It doesn't make intuitive sense. And one way of understanding it is that if you were a car, your IQ would be the engine and your processing would be the gearbox. And some people are manual gearboxes, slow processors, and some people are automatic gearboxes. fast processors. It doesn't make your Ferrari any different, whether it's a manual Ferrari or an automatic Ferrari. It's still a Ferrari, but you need to learn how to drive your manual Ferrari. Otherwise, it'll just stall in the road and feel like a milk cart compared to what it can be. And that's the experience most people with dyslexia find, because their manual gearboxes when it comes to organizing their going through the process of learning to read and learning to study. Right. And so this is where that automaticity comes in that we've talked about. This is where you've talked about rapid automatic naming. And often you might think of somebody brings up a name like benevolent really quickly. It's not because it's automatic sometimes, it's because it's rapid manual naming. They've gone through this process of stitching together the images, and they've kind of, there's these gears of going up into their imagination, grabbing it and bringing it down. It's not just a reflex. It's not like, oh, this is my right, this is my left. A lot of people have to think, right, my left hand looks like an L, so that's left. And they get so good at it, so quick at it, it looks like they know what their left and the right is. But they don't automatically know what their left and the right is necessarily. They're rapidly manual naming it. But the rapidness comes from, you know, having practiced it. It's like going through the gears. You can be a race car driver, rapidly get up to 70 miles an hour into fifth and sixth gear in seconds, sometimes even faster than an automatic gearbox can, because you have complete control. And I think that's part of that dynamic you brought in at the beginning of this conversation about master and what was the phrase?
The master morality versus the coping.
The master morality. I don't understand the morality, but is it mentality or coping mentality? Is it morality mentality?
Yeah, let's call it mentality.
Okay, so the master mentality and the coping mentality. So the master mentality would correlate to someone who's automatically good at something, starts to get frustrated with someone who's not automatically good and is manual at it. The coping mentality is they've learned how to cope, they've learned how to go through the gears, and so they know how to teach it.
You know, the other thing I want to bring in too is that some people, some manual learners, if we follow that, can eventually learn it through repetition. And other ones, kind of more like me, repetition doesn't work. It just creates frustration and agitation, and it just doesn't matter how much repetition doesn't work. I'm the type of person that needs those memory strategies. And when I use the memory strategies, that helps me to encode it. And I'll give you an example. I really struggle with the names for things. Things like, I remember when I was little, broccoli, cauliflower, asparagus. I knew what it was. I just couldn't access those names. And now in my life, it manifests as the names of flowers because I have a garden and I can never remember the names of my flowers. So I'm now using memory strategies. So for example, I often plant coleus. And so I thought, okay, coal. So I'm going to imagine that in the middle of the coleus is a big black piece of coal. And I have that hooking strategy of the coal, but then I also visualize it, which just gets it that much more encoded. And impatience, I could never remember the name, which is really hilarious. I could never remember the name for impatience until I realized that how impatient I got when I couldn't remember the name impatience. And then I was like, oh, got it. Oh, right. Geraniums. I was like, it's such a weird name. It's so out there, abstract. How do you relate to that? Well, geranium rhymes with cranium. And it's kind of funny how a geranium looks like a cranium. So, but this is what I do now for all the flowers in my garden. And this season, what I really want to do is record the name of each one and literally document my strategies. Because some of them I'm like, oh, what was the strategy? You know, write them down, spend a little bit more time visualizing it, creating those hooks so that I can walk around my garden and just say, oh, look at the coleus. Oh, look at the geraniums. And just boom, it comes to me immediately. So even if you or your kids have rapid automatic naming issues, there's no reason why they can't get to that point. So some need repetition. Others need those kinds of strategies. And eventually the strategies will drop away once it becomes automatic.
Yes. So rapid automatic naming starts as rapid manual naming, or in actual fact, the process is slow is smooth, smooth is fast. So you slowly, so it's slow manual naming, which becomes smooth manual naming, which becomes rapid automatic naming. So you can get to the rapid automatic naming, but there are a few steps. And it is a bit frustrating, but the moment you figure out how to do it, you've got a reliable way of remembering whatever you want.
You have to start with intention.
Yes.
That's the key. If you don't have the intention, you don't have the drive, you don't have the motivation, you'll never have that. So, you know, there, I can't tell you how many times where I've said, oh, I really need to memorize all the names of my flowers. And I just haven't done it because I haven't ever stopped and said, okay, that's it. Here's my intention. Here's my plan, which goes back to last week's discussion.
Last week's episode, yes. That's what I'm thinking right now.
Right? We got to create that plan. We've got to make that commitment to that plan or that routine, and then we can learn it. And then for me, I have to integrate those memory strategies. And when I do, and I love memory strategies too, because it makes it so amusing, which just really alleviates my anxiety. You know, cranium geranium, it always makes me giggle.
I had that experience with a student yesterday. One of the techniques that we use with the bullet map process is a flash map, which ties into an executive functioning technique that I know you're putting into your program, which is spaced repetition. And so what I did with the child and I do with the children is let's draw out a map that is a map of biology, for example, or an essay or something like that, an essay structure that they've got to do. And then they've got to turn the map over so they can't see it. And they've got to scribble it down, doodle it down really fast in about 4 minutes, and to see what kind of bits of the map they can remember.
Oh, so they're replicating the map that they already did.
That's right. Yes. They're doing a copy of it, but not an exact copy that like takes 15 minutes or 20 minutes or 30 minutes to nicely redraw. It's just a rapid sketch. And they know that that squiggle is the car. And they know that squiggle is that guy's crazy glasses and the mustache and so on. And they know what they all mean. And then you'd flip it back over and you give yourself a point for every element in the map, for every picture, every word, a key element in the map. So there might be about 50 elements in the map and they get 20 points out of the 50. And so it's like, let's do it again. And they do it again and they doodle it and then they get 30 and then they do it again and they get 40. And then, but then what's happened is that they look at the map and they keep seeing that they forget a particular area or something like that. And then it's kind of like, well, obviously we need to do a better picture for that, a better doodle or something. And that's what they do. And then they get to the 50 out of 50 and they're like, wow, this is great. And what happens is in the spaced repetition side of things, it's like, right, let's just leave it. And tomorrow when you wake up or decide to, whenever you want, think of the map, try and spend 3 minutes doing a quick doodle of it and see how many points you get. And they do doodle and they get 35 points off from a standing start, not having seen it for a day. And they're like, oh, wow, that's great. And then it's like, well, don't look at it for a week. And then when we meet again next week, let's do a quick flash map of it. And what's constantly happening is before they even look at the map, they're stimulating the brain to go through the hard effort of finding that pathway again and reinforcing it. And also identifying the areas where they've not got a strong enough memory strategy.
And I love how you gamify it. Games are really cool. I love how you get them to visualize, which is another memory strategy. And then there's the tactile component. The tactile component, which also brings in a level of sequencing. So you're using multiple cognitive processing areas to help them to encode the information, which is really beautiful. And Einstein said, a picture says 1,000 words, but you're bringing in all of these other senses.
Mm.
at the same time. So you're really, it's a very multi-sensory approach to memorization, which I love. It's really your own unique memory strategy.
Isn't it funny? Actually, there are certain elements of what I do that I'm that master mentality, and other elements that I'm the coping mentality.
Yeah, we all have that. I'll never forget taking geometry, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is so easy. And it was the first time I ever took a class where I was like, oh my gosh, how could someone not understand this? And I was like, oh, then I had compassion for the people that got frustrated with me, because obviously what was hard for me was easy for them, right?
Yes, yes. So I think that is very much the case with our way, the way our brains are wired, that there are certain elements of our brains that are very manual processing and certain elements that are very automatic. And I think looking at the Dyslexic Advantage book, you see that the Brocks are trying to argue that, you know, it's not just a deficit with dyslexia, it's a different allocation of brain resources to different parts of the brain. And it's kind of like you're designing a car and you say, right, instead of spending an extra $2,000 on an automatic transmission, let's go for a manual transmission and spend that $2,000 on beefing up the engine or having better suspension or some sort of ratchet mechanism for pulling things out of the mud, etc. There's been a different allocation in the brain to specialize the brain for, optimize it for a different set of tasks.
Well, and I'm glad you brought in that book, because it's a very, very good book. I really like it. It's called The Dyslexic Advantage, and it's by Brock and Frenette. Just for everybody to know, it's a book that we both really like and promote. So you guys will have to check that out. This was an incredible discussion.
Yeah, we should stop. Let's carry on the discussion next week. I don't know where it'll go next week, what we'll be doing next week, but we'll surprise you next week with the next episode. We'll carry on. We're still working on different techniques. And I think we've already talked about tons of really practical on the ground techniques in this episode. Erica, thank you so much for this convo.
Well, and I have to thank you, because you're the one that said, Erica, let's not over-organize this, because I am just an organization freak. And you're like, let's just go into it. What I really love, Erica, are our discussions. Do we have to over-organize it? Because then it doesn't work as well. And let's just go in and share our actual discussion, which is what we did. And it was a lot of fun. Let's do more of this.
And get in touch with us whichever way you think it goes, you know, chaos or order. I think I really love Jordan Peterson's analysis of life is this finding this balance between chaos and order. And it's that middle ground of too much order is really bad. Too much chaos is really bad. We need the human condition is finding that tension, holding that tension between chaos and order, which is kind of what we're doing in this podcast.
Well, and it's interesting because you and I have such different brains where, you know, I can't think unless things are super ordered. And I think
I like thinking on my feet.
Yes, yes. And I appreciate how you've really pulled me into that way of processing. And I think we'll do a little bit of both. I think
a little bit of both. And that's the beauty of life, really, and teamwork, that you help keep that equilibrium between the two of you.
Yep. Well, thanks again, Darius. And I look forward to our next discussion.
Yeah, next week. Thanks for listening in to our crazy conversations.
Thank you for joining our conversation here at the Personal Brain Trainer Podcast. This is Dr. Erica Warren.
And Darius Nomdaron. Check out the show notes for links to resources mentioned in the podcast. And please leave us a review and share us on social media. Until next time, bye.
Bye.